genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
He was born in Washington, D.C., began playing the piano at the tender age of 9. He had a real aptitude for music. He picked up other instruments like the banjo, the acoustic, and the bass guitar. He moved to New York City. He became part of the folk movement scene up there in Greenwich Village in the first half of the 1960s. There he met people like Richie Furay, the Mamas and the Papas, and Stephen Stills. Stephen Stills, in fact, suggested that Peter audition for a new television series about four pop rock musicians. Peter got the job and became one of the original four members of the Monkees, who ended up being both characters in a television sitcom and a band in their own right. He also co-wrote the closing theme song for the Monkees, which is titled For Pete's Sake. On the television show, Peter was relegated to playing the lovable dummy, even though he's actually a highly intelligent, literate person, as the other Monkees have been keen to point out in their subsequent interviews. Peter continues to play music to this day. His latest band is called Shoe Suede Blues. Welcome to the show, Peter. How are you doing today?
Much better than I thought.
Well, you've had a wonderful life.
Sorry?
I say you've had a wonderful life. In fact, I mean, I'll start the whole thing out by saying you're sort of, in my mind, the embodiment of the American dream. I mean, you're a talented young guy, and you ride the elevator to the pinnacle of popular success, and then you have a slip, and you hit the skids, you face your demons, you overcome them, and you're back doing what you love doing, which is making music. I mean, I think that's what this country's all about. That's very cool.
Put it in those terms, it doesn't get any better than that, does it?
It really doesn't, so you are that embodiment. So let's start with the early part of your career with the Monkees. And just tell me, Peter, what was it like being part of a mega group in the 1960s?
Compared to what?
Well, compared to just being an ordinary citizen in Washington, D.C.
Busy,
huh? Did they keep you on the move all the time?
Well, yeah. I mean, at one point, the schedule was, you know, get up at 6:30, be on stage at 7:30 in the morning, work for 11 and a half hours, basically, half hour for makeup, and then go to work at 8, and work until about 7 that night. At one point, they were, okay, that's a wrap, shut down the set, dash out of this, didn't even bother to wipe makeup off, and dash to grab a hamburger on the way to the recording studio and work in the recording studio until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock that night. In my case, I also was seeing a lovely lady about a half an hour out of town, and so I drove off to spend the night with her, and, you know, I was probably operating on 4 hours sleep a night for a little while there. So,
wow.
Between my love life and the business life, it was pretty hectic, all right, for a bit.
Well, I think that most people really fail to recognize how demanding stardom is, and like you were just saying, that's a 24/7 job right there.
It was Paul Newman, I think, who said, if you're not crazy to do this, you're crazy to do this.
Well said. Well, in all of that mayhem and all of that hard work that you were doing, Peter, what did you like best about the experience?
Well, for me, actually, the stuff I like the best is being backstage. Watching
really?
It be made. I love watching television being made. I love the director and how does he choose this? How does he pick that angle? Why does he send everybody here? What marks are they hitting and why? And what's the lighting and why this? And, you know, it's amazing, too, you know, watching the process. You know, I've been an actor basically in high school and college and amateur theatricals since I can't remember when, you know, entirely all probably as long as I've been playing music. And you learn how to act, you learn how to say your lines, you learn how to speak clearly, and then you go into Hollywood, and that is not enough skill.
Really?
You can't miss your mark. You know, if you're on stage, you have an area you have to hit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to get hidden behind somebody, but if you're within 3 or 4 feet of where you're supposed to be hitting most of the time, that's plenty good. And on television, you have to hit your mark within, you know, 3 or 4 inches.
Wow.
And because they're not only do they have to see you, but they have to focus, and they know ahead of time what the focus is. But if you're not, if you miss your mark by too much, they can't adjust the focus sufficiently to be sure to catch you, or else you'll be throwing somebody else out of focus. And then, on top of that, you have to make sure you're not overlapping anybody else's lines. You can do that on stage. You overlap lines. It's realistic. It's how people talk. They can't let you do that on television because your second take might be better than his third take over there, and they can't get them apart and put them back, put them together to make the best show possible if you're actually overlapping and talking. Those kinds of differences.
Wow.
You know, so it's a whole new skill. Acting on screen, acting for camera, is another skill. And, of course, you know, you're standing on stage and you make a big, broad gesture. You open your mouth wide. You swing your arms wide. Well, if they're looking up at your face, you look grotesque and they can't see what your arms are doing. So, you have to adjust your gestures for the size of the shot. Is it a medium shot, in which case you move your arms somewhat? Is it tight close-up, in which case you can't move your arms at all? And your expressions have to be smaller on a tight close-up. All of that. You know, so it's a complete other thing. But I love this. I love watching all that. I love learning that stuff. I love camera length and focal length. I loved watching records be made. I learned how to make records there. And, doing shows. I love all that.
Ah, we're talking to Peter Tork, everybody. And I think it's interesting, Peter, that you like the whole process of television, because the Monkey Show, when it was on the air, was relatively innovative for that time in television. I mean, you had snappy bits, you had one-liners, zingers, and it was really fundamentally very interesting to me that here was this show trying to show America that long-haired musicians, teenage musicians, could be acceptable to our moms and our dads. So, really, I mean, that's the way I viewed it. So
yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
So tell me a little bit about the pace that you set, because I think The Monkey Show was really the precursor to Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. It was on the same network. They used the same types of shots. From your artistic opinion, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, but it's beside the point.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the thing about the Monkees that's most important is that the Monkees, and I think the reason why the Monkees the influence of the Monkees has lasted, has been as big a deal as it has, is that the Monkees was a TV show about four young adults with no senior adult authority figure. Now, this was not only radical and revolutionary, it was flat out unique. In the absolute sense of that word, it had never been done before and never was done again for decades. And the significance of that was that the Monkees was being shot at a time when, as far as most people's opinions go, the authority in this country had collapsed. The presidents were sending young men to fight a war that had no relevance to the well-being of this country. The Vietnam War was absolutely not a war on behalf of the American people. It was absolutely a war on behalf, well, I put it like it was on behalf of the egos of the various presidents. World War II was, everybody regarded that as a highly moral war. And everybody, all the presidents after that, didn't want to be caught not prosecuting wars that threatened, but they didn't threaten the American well-being. They threatened America's ego, and that was, and they couldn't resist. So they went to war badly, in a war they didn't understand, for purposes that were not directly useful. And they didn't care about the American people. They cared about their egos. And the result is that we're still in that mode. Seriously, 40 years later, we haven't gotten out of that mode, fighting wars. Now, I actually happen to believe that with Obama, that if Afghanistan had been prosecuted properly, we might have done something seriously good on behalf of the nation's well-being. But there you got a president who was going to, out Oedipus his father. No, that man threatened my daddy. I'm going to take him down. And he did. And we got into a war that did not directly impinge upon our well-being for reasons that were strictly bogus, entirely bogus, and they couldn't handle that. So here we have a situation where the authority was bogus, was out of touch with the American people, and all of the TV shows up till then had been off the World War II model. My father knows best.
Right. Leave It to Beaver, all of those shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all those kinds of shows.
Mm-hmm.
And The Monkees was a show where the authorities could not be counted on, but we weren't depressed about that. The four lads faced life together cheerfully and got along and made out okay. Nothing great, you know. Stayed under the radar pretty much, but certainly it was much better than everything else that was going on at the time. And I think that that fact that the Monkees had no authority figure was the determining factor. It gave everybody a sense, all those little kids, you know, finally had a chance to believe that it was possible to get together with your friends and get along, and that was enough. No other show ever gave them any. That was entirely below the radar. Nobody ever said anything about it out loud. It took me years to notice it myself.
Wow. I mean, that's great insight from Peter Tork, everybody, one of the original members of the Monkees. And Peter, that's very insightful. I want to come back and harp on that for just a minute more, taking a look at the Monkees. What other milestones do you think that the show set, both in television, music, and the way we combine media today?
Well, you're talking about the MTV thing, which I think Mike Nesmith claims and probably deserves a great deal of credit for. As a result of what we called the romps, which were basically music videos, I hasten to add that I saw things called Scopitone when I was a young man in the village, and those were movie cassettes that you put a buck in this. It was basically a movie jukebox, and they were songs to film. They were like very much like music videos that came later. Still in all, that idea didn't exactly explode, but then the Monkees did what we called our romps, which is, you know, clowning around to or apparent performances to the songs that we were promoting songs, of course, and all that. So there was also the issue of the cross-pollinization commercially. The shows promoted the songs promoted the show, and both of those created the pop phenomenon, made the Monkees huge pop stars. We used to play to, you know, 18 to 50 to 40,000. We once, actually in Reunion, the Monkees once played to 200,000 in Boston.
200,000?
This was only recently, too. This was much more recent. This is like 5 years. No, well, a little bit more.
Well, a testament to your enduring value and in your enduring love by the fans out there. Let me ask you, we're talking to Peter Tork, everybody. Let me ask you, Peter, what are some of your favorite Monkees songs?
My favorite Monkees songs, my favorite piece of Monkees music, my favorite thing that ever happened that got recorded was a song called Ryu Shiyu, which was an acoustic, for many reasons. Musically, I think it is the most wonderful thing that we heard. It was a cappella,
right?
No instruments at all. And you heard, the only thing that the four of us ever all sang on at once. And the blend, to my ear, is so good that I have a hard time picking out who's singing which part. The vocal blend was really, for the first time, we had a really grand quartet vocal blend, which I had never heard out of us before. And finally, and most wonderfully, it was done live to camera. In those days, as you know, Mr. Brain, we recorded songs in the recording studio, which is much cheaper than a television set. Recording studio in those days, the equipment was like about $200 for a good recording studio and an hour, and, you know, $2,000 to $5,000 an hour for a good TV studio. Now, at those rates, you don't let anybody sing their songs on live on camera. What if they blow it and you have to do it again? Get it right in the recording studio and then lip sync to it on the soundstage of the television studio. But in this one case, they made an exception. We sang live to camera. We did it twice, and it went up on the Christmas episode that year. And so for all those reasons, my favorite piece of Monkees music is Ryu Shiyu.
Ryu Shiyu. We're talking to Peter Tork, everybody. Peter, we're going to have to take a break. But when we come back, I want you to think about this while we're on commercial. I want to talk about the dynamics within the group and also the dynamics with Don Kirshner. Don't answer that now because I know this is a loaded question. Answer it when we come back after this short break.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can't be here by 4:30 cause I've made your reservation. Don't be slow. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no, no, no.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain, and we're having just a delightful conversation with Peter Tork of the Monkees. And before we get back to Peter, I do have to do a little business here. We've got a giveaway, so get your fingers ready to dial 639-0008, 639-0008. This is a coupon for a free sandwich or salad from Urbane Cafe, their new location in Oxnard, the intersection of Gonzales and Rose Avenue. Brand new building, beautiful location down there. Win this coupon, you get a free sandwich or free lunch. Just in time for lunch today. What's my appetite just thinking about it? Urbane Cafe. Be the second caller at 639-0008, 639-0008, and the coupon is yours. Now, Peter, back to you. When we before we went away to break, I wanted to talk a little bit about the dynamics within the group, because history has shown us that there were some interesting dynamics going on between the four players. You, there was Mike Nesmith, of course, there was Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones. How did that, first of all, you guys were cast together as, first of all, a TV show, and then as a rock group second. How did you all come together, and how did people tend to gravitate towards one another within the group? Loaded question.
It's a hell of a question, Billy. Yes, we were auditioned and selected by Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson, who really were the chief honchos of the Monkees. Everything else is... is just handymen, and that's all. We were just hired gunslingers. It must be noted that they went to great lengths to make sure. Well, how to put this exactly? If they had had to pick guys who couldn't do music and who couldn't do a musical show, they would have gone with it. But their hope was to get guys who could also do music to some extent or another.
Okay.
And the fact that Michael and I had been playing around, and that Mickey actually was a campfire guitar player too,
mm-hmm.
he was, and he put out pop records, he put out a record, Mickey and the One-Nighters, I think. He also had a group called The Missing Links, if you believe that.
Yes, yes.
And Davey, of course, was singing on Broadway. So, we knew we had our Herman's Hermits, and we had our rock singers, and we had our country singer, and we had our folky. And they knew all this. If we couldn't have done the TV show, we wouldn't have been cast. So that was first, because that had to happen, according to their plan. We were cast... with half an eye towards doing music, and the other half towards, but the first part, of course, being making the TV show. And they didn't want regular Hollywood types. They really did want offbeat kids who could be counted on to bring something else. They had hopes of doing something different, and they knew that people who had been, most people, who came up through the ranks along Hollywood child actors would be very staid and would know exactly what was expected of them, and we would get another I Dream of Jeannie, which, not to denigrate that, but it wasn't what they had in mind. So they wanted offbeat, they wanted musicians, had to be television actors, had finally be, and, we'd all had enough. Michael is the least experienced actor of the bunch. He didn't have any troubles, So, that then, it was like, how are you guys? You are the Monkees. Meet each other. Well, I knew Mike. Mickey knew Mike. Mike was the Hootenanny director at the Troubadour. Mm-hmm. He's a funny guy too, and everybody, he was just a great, great guy at that. He was really wonderful, so we knew him. None of us had met Davey before, I don't think. Maybe Mickey just quickly, and. So, hi, how are you? Nice to meet you. That's it, we're the cast members, then the dynamics began. Now, I'm not going to try to encapsulate the dynamics among the four of us in a couple of dozen hours for you, but much less words. But suffice it to say that it was complicated, and the relationships that pretty much, I think the relationships that we have among us now, or between any two of us, were set right then, right away. They are a function of who we really are, not of any external circumstance. Right now, I'm not talking to Mike, and Mike hasn't spoken to me, and that's been 13 years. And that's not likely to change. It's possible, but not likely. And that's who we are. It's a function of who Mike is and who I am, not of anything that, I mean, you know, I would say it was because of certain behaviors, but those are Michael's behaviors, and that's who he is. And so it goes, you know. I talk to Mickey, I talk to Davey, we get along fine, and exactly how we get along, those two are established by who we are. Mickey's very professional and a little uptight, in my view, and so everything is like, well, how it's done, you know. Like I said, you know, you come up through showbiz, kids, as he was.
As he was, right.
And his parents were in showbiz. And so you come up as he did, and by gosh, things have to be according to the industry standard. We don't, you know, otherwise things can't get done. Everything has to be done the way things are done so that they'll get done, because otherwise they don't get done. And,
okay.
You know, and Davey, Davey has... Well, I'm not going to go into detail.
All right. Well, we'll just let that slide. I want to talk about another dynamic that was equally interesting, in my opinion, and that is you guys were untried and untrue as a group together, and nobody knew about songwriting skills, especially early on. So they brought in the hit maker, as it was, of the time, Don Kirshner, and his stable of writers, which included Carole King, it included Neil Diamond, several other very famous names, and they were actually writing the songs for you. Kirshner was orchestrating them and putting them out there. And yet there was a tension between the Monkees as the group that wanted to play music and Don Kirshner himself. What was that relationship like, and how did that eventually play itself out?
Gosh, well, I don't know how to encapsulate this sufficiently for our purposes here, Billy. This is a, it's a big topic. It's all, there's a small book in this one all just by itself. Kirshner had... his audience and knew exactly what they wanted to hear and was able to come up with it and generate it. He also did not, you know, it's like one of those people who says, you don't like me. And I said, well, I do too. Well, that's what it feels like.
Oh, yeah.
The way kids are sometimes. Don did not get when we said, listen, Donnie, we just don't want to be, you keep on picking the songs. We just want to be the musicians in the studio. You pick the songs. We're great for that. Let us make the song, make the records. He thought we were telling him that we didn't like him, that he wasn't, we didn't want have anything to do with him, that we were taking over everything that he stood dear for. He thought we were trying to usurp his entire personality, and he threw a tremendous fit and blew his own situation. In fact, all I wanted, I mean, I don't know what anybody said to anybody, but I tell you what I wanted was to be the musicians in the studio. We make the records. You get to pick the songs, pick the authors. We know you know what you're doing. For God's sake, let's go with this, you know. And he didn't, you know, he didn't get it. To this day, I would rather he had stuck around. And incidentally, his enduring quest to prove his original position correct. Apparently, he has been an uncredited producer of three out of the four Where Are They Now specials that have gone out on cables. You know, who did, Murphy did one, MTV did one, the Discovery Channel maybe did one. I don't remember who else, you know.
Right.
There were four of these things. And in every one of them, the Monkees...
Oh, there, Peter. We're
losing themselves up big time by firing by crossing Don Kirshner.
Gotcha.
And it's flat out not true. And there's nothing I can do about that, you know, because he had managed to find the way to make that point be part of these Monkees' bios. And people came to me and they said, "Well, would you do an interview?" Yeah. And nobody said to me, "Well, what do you think about the notion that Don that you messed yourselves up with. They didn't ask me that question.
It's all in the way they asked the question.
Sorry?
I say it's all in the way they asked the question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, they didn't ask me, do you think Don Kirshner, that you believe? Because for one thing, the facts aren't there. The second album sold less than the first, and the third sold less than the second.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth sold less than the third. It was just part of the natural decline. The Monkees were an explosive phenomenon, and then there was the dust settles after a while.
Exactly.
But the third album was not didn't fall off from the second by as much as the second fell off from the first. In other words, we brought something new to that album, the third album, Headquarters, the one we made without Donnie.
Right.
And so, which I think puts the lie to the notion that Don was the be-all and end-all. He made the Monkees, and he brought us down when he left. And Donnie, if you're listening to this, come home, all is forgiven, okay?
We're talking to Peter Tork, everybody, one of the original members of the Monkees. Peter, I want to leave the Monkees behind, and let's turn to what you're doing now. You've got a new band. It's called Shoe Suede Blues. Tell me, what sorts of music are you pursuing with the new band? What do you like best about being in Shoe Suede Blues?
I'll answer the second question first. The thing I like best about being in Shoe Suede Blues is playing the real blues, which I don't do as much as I might like. But given my history and the fact that people who pay my way, i.e., the fans who come in the door, are seeing some kind of a connection to their earlier lives, it is incumbent upon me to play Monkees songs. Now, in some ways, this is very fortunate because I don't know whether I would play those songs if I were an entirely strictly blues band. But by bluesing them up a little bit, I managed to make them part of what it is I like to do and remind the folks of why they're coming to see me. So, for instance, you just played Clarksville.
Yes, we did.
And that's the most radical change we've made. We do sometimes do She Hangs Out, which used to be Do They Run, They Run, Day Do They. Now we do Do They Run, They Run, Day Do They Run, Run. She Hangs Out, Bow, Bow, Down, 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 Bow, Down, Boom, which is different, but we do it roughly at the same tempo, same lyrics, same arrangement, and people almost don't notice.
It's because memory fades as time goes on, I suppose.
And we get to do them the way we want, pretty much, and remind them of what they came to hear. And that's wonderful. I'm delighted to do Monkees songs again. We do bluesy pop songs. And one of the things about the name of the band is that it harkens back to an era when country and rockabilly and blues pop and the relatively hard rock and all those kinds of different music, kinds of pop music, we're being played on the same radio stations.
Right.
So you had Little Richard next to Pat Boone, usually doing the same songs. Pat Boone outselling Little Richard by stealing his song.
Exactly. Peter, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Oh, no,
the time just flies
just
so quickly. My special guest, Peter Tork, thank you so much for being on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Coming up next is Living Your Inspired Life with Susan Burrell. Join us here tomorrow when Bill Watkins from CLU will be here talking about the local economy. We'll talk to you then.
KKZZ Santa Paula.